Hello, and thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are hundreds more of these conversations that you can get free of charge and with no ads because we're the ABC. Go to abc.net.au/conversations or just go to iTunes and search for Conversations with Richard Feidler. And while you're there, you can subscribe to this program if you like and have a conversation delivered to you every weekday automatically. It's easy.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to the last Conversations program for 2010. We will be back in the new year, but I thought I'd go out this year the same way as last year by bringing you Funny Stories 2010. These are the stories from the people who are on the show this year. They're all true, or mostly true, because funny stories are allowed a little embellishment here and there. There's stories from writers, musicians, there's an archaeologist, and there are a couple of comedians too. And here's the thing, for some reason, this year, all of them come from women. All of them. This isn't some politically correct, you know, give the girls a go type of thing. It's just the way it's turned out this year. I have no better explanation than that. Before we get started, I should let you know that some of these stories may not be perfectly suitable for children's ears, so you might want to send them outside for the hour to play. Today you'll hear from Gretel Colleen, Claire Bowditch, Mary Wilson from The Supremes, Corinne Grant, and soul music legend Darlene Love. First, I've got to start with Hannah Gadsby. Hannah is a comedian born in Tasmania, and she's got a growing international reputation. Hannah Gadsby is like a lot of comedians. Her relationship with her parents, particularly her mother, has given her plenty of material. It gets a little complicated, though, when you're doing that material on stage in your hometown with mum in the audience. First up, I asked Hannah about the source of the tension in the mother-daughter relationship.
She and I have an interesting relationship because I'm incredibly accident prone and always have been. And Mum has a pathological fear of doctors and a complete mistrust of the sick and injured. It was disastrous. Like, there were so many instances where things got worse than they really should have.
What?
Gallstones, which you can understand. You wouldn't necessarily believe that your child has gallstones. I was 15. And so I'd tell Mum, because I'd get up and have breakfast, and by the time I got to school, then I'd have the attack. And then school would go, oh, that's not good, send me home. And Mum's like, what's wrong with you? You look all right. Because, you know, you have the attack and you're fine. You're like, no, I was really sick. No, you're not. By the time I got to the doctor, I was passing out ill. And he said, look, she's got gallstones. We probably need to operate and get them out. And she's like, no, she doesn't, you stupid man. What would you know? You just want my money. Yeah. Yeah. And, well, it's a free healthcare system, Mrs. Gadsby. But when I was diagnosed, she put me in, you know, instead of a course of painkillers and surgery, she said she's got a bellyache, she just needs to keep busy, you know. She just needs to do some more chores around the house. and then when that didn't work, she tried.
Housework didn't cure you.
Yeah, so when I got...
Didn't cure the gallstones.
No. Controversial.
Okay.
And then she tried, when I got jaundice, she tried sherry.
Oh, that's dangerous, though.
I know.
That could have killed you if you've got your liver, you know, blocked up. And
it could have been. Later in life, I did get pancreatitis. Probably a direct result of Mum's home remedies.
Tell me why your mum heckled you.
Well, when I started doing stand-up, she's very sceptical about the whole thing, but she was glad that I was doing something because I'm a notorious time waster in my family. And there was a gig in Hobart. They had a little comedy festival there, and I was very new, very excited, and I invited her to come along, and she needed a bit of Dutch courage. She was nervous. She was nervous. She went to a bar down the way in Salamanca and had a couple of wines and was half tanked by the time she got there. And I wasn't the only person performing that night, so I can't say she left all the heckling for me. She heckled everybody. And what the first guy tried to engage with her, and she just told him that, you know, well, I've had a couple of wines and they were $8 each, $16, and I got two wines and I could have bought a whole cask for that. And I'm up the back going, Jesus, that's my mother. No one knew it was my mum at the time. And then a nice Josh Earle, a young comic, got up and did a song about librarians, and the song begins with, shh. And my mum's just like, don't you shush me. I paid money. And it just got increasingly worse until a guy got on stage and he was doing a joke about Starbucks, like just a little joke about Starbucks. And my mum was like, what's Starbucks? Because, you know, we didn't have Starbucks where I'm from. And he's like, it threw him because he's like, well, everyone knows. Well, it's like McDonald's for coffee, you know. It's just where you buy coffee. And she's like, oh, I thought it was a movie. And it threw him for a bit, but he recovered and he kept talking. And seriously, it might have been about 5 minutes later, Mum's just gone, oh, no, sorry, that's Star Wars, isn't it?
I think it's going to be any comedian's worst fear.
People thought she was a double act because by the time I got on stage, it was just out of hand. And so I was just telling stories about her. And there's this story I tell about when she had an accident and she fell over and she came home doubled over in pain. And we sort of said, what did you do? And she reckoned she fell over onto a finger and cracked a rib. Like she somehow stuck a finger into her ribs and cracked them. And we were always just giving her grief about that, going, how do you do that? You can't. But she clearly hurt herself. Like there's no doubt, but she didn't get x-rays or diagnosed or anything. She just drank a lot of sherry. But whenever people would ask her, oh, you know, what's happened to you? Well, you're in a lot of pain. What's happened to you? She would just go, well, I fingered myself and I cracked a rib. And it's just sort of like that, oh. So I told that story on stage and everyone laughed except Mum. And she stood up and just said, well, I did. I don't know what's so funny. And it didn't matter what I said, she'd just stand up and go, don't laugh at her. Don't encourage her. She's not funny.
You won't admit you love me. It's comedian Hannah Gadsby from earlier this year. Claire Bowditch, ARIA award-winning singer-songwriter. This year, Claire got to have a crack at being an interviewer. And the subject for her interview was another high-profile, influential Australian woman, the Prime Minister. But Claire's somewhat famous in her circle of friends for her Julia Gillard impersonation. And I was wondering if they were goading her to do her Julia Gillard impersonation to Julia Gillard. During the election campaign, you got to interview Julia Gillard for
yes,
an hour.
Yes.
How did that work out?
How extraordinary is that fact? And the truth is I don't know how it worked. I just don't know. But it did spark on this Julia Gillard, this impersonation that I do. We are negotiating on a very important agreement. And for some reason I found myself in a room then a week before the election with Ms. Gillard for an hour. And it was wonderful. It was extraordinary.
Did you do that impersonation to her?
I did. Look, I couldn't bring myself to do the impersonation itself in person. But what I did was I really had to confess. We had a lot of rapport building. We talked about Beyonce and Gaga. We had a lovely light 10 minutes at the beginning. And I did have to say to her, Ms. Gillard, yes, I'm known for impersonating you. I wonder if you could help me perfect the karate chop hands. And so we did. And she said, oh, you know, I'm terribly embarrassed.
Listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online and on digital. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
And today you're listening to the final Conversations for 2010, Funny Stories 2010, stories delivered by Conversations guests throughout the year. The next story is from the ruins of Pompeii, the ancient Roman city that was completely destroyed by ash and fire and lava when Vesuvius erupted next to it in 79 AD. We know quite a bit about how those ancient Romans lived by the bits and pieces they left lying around. But aside from some old mosaics, we don't know all that much about how those Romans looked. Dr. Estelle Laser is an Australian archaeologist who goes to Pompeii, and she locks herself up with thousands of bones belonging to those Romans who died that day. She normally conducts her work well out of the spotlight, so Estelle wasn't at all prepared when she found herself at the centre of a London tabloid news story under the provocative headline of "The Fat, Hairy Women of Pompeii." I have to ask you, Estelle, who were the fat, hairy women of Pompeii?
All right, this is the bane of my life. One of the things that I was looking at were what disorders people had. Inside the skulls of a number of the individuals, they presented with extra bony deposits, so they're like benign tumours on the inside of the frontal bone of the skull. And this can be fairly confidently diagnosed. It's an endocrine disorder that's almost always associated with older women, postmenopausal women. They tend to obesity and non-insulin-dependent diabetes associated with it. They can develop male hair patterns, so grow a beard, and they can get headaches. What was really exciting about it was that I found so many cases.
So your discovery of this disorder in these women of Pompeii was reported in New Scientist. How was that then picked up by the international media? And
they just went wild. The sub-editor of New Scientist put in a heading that said "The Fat, Hairy Ladies of Pompeii," and the world went berserk. And I was sent news clippings from all over the world. So I think the London Sun had a picture of Frankie Howard from up Pompeii with two nubile young maidens and the heading "Not True." And the Italian press had headings "Fat, Ugly, Hairy." Australian archaeologist Estelle Laser says our women were really ugly, and they had conferences about it and decided I couldn't be correct because Venus was the patron deity of Pompeii, so therefore they were beautiful. But worst of all, I was sitting in my office, you know, I'd led a fairly sheltered life, I guess, and I got this phone call from a gentleman who identified himself as being from News of the World, which I'd never heard of, and he started asking me the normal questions, said, "Oh, this is an endocrine disorder," and I said, "Correct," and "Women get male hair patterns and some male features," I said, "Correct." And he said, "Do their clitorises get really big?" And I went, "Excuse me?" well, the truth is they do. And I just had this inkling of the career-destroying headlines, "Fat hairy chicks with big clits." So
of Pompeii.
Of Pompeii. So I tried to be very, very boring. And I said, "It doesn't actually present on the skeletal record."
Pompeii, up Pompeii. I never seem to get it. Up Pompeii, Pompeii.
Archaeologist Estelle Laser. And if you've just joined me on Conversations, we're going out this year with Funny Stories 2010. Resentment, envy, displeasure at someone else's good fortune. These are all emotions we sometimes reserve for our best friends. It's the theme for one of the short stories of Karen Hitchcock. This year at the Sydney Writers' Festival, I spoke with Karen, and our session was in front of a live audience. Karen, I want to talk about your writing a bit more now. I'd love you to do a reading from your book, Little White Slips. There's a really funny story in there called Fat Ass. It's about the way women look at each other and each other's bodies and how disappointed they can be when one of their friends lose weight. That'd
okay.
Be fantastic.
All right. Tina approaches me from behind the way that she does, addicted as she is to checking out my ass, hoping it's still bigger than hers, and it is. And her smile is genuinely happy. "How are you?" she asks, gripping my arm. "You look great," she lies. It had happened the way that it does, gradually, over a year or three. No time to jog, more reasons to bake cake, more money to eat out, to buy ingredients hand-snipped and shipped directly from Spain. not to mention bad genes. And notice how everyone's an amateur chef now, and that hideous word foodie. Nigella drools and licks, and suddenly hedonism's legitimate. I simply stop saying no. Cream? Indiscriminate. Butter? Make mine thick and Danish. Cheese? Unmitigated. Chocolate? Let it pour where it will. Suddenly you have a midnight argument for the eating of cake. You're not fat. They're your sexy, luscious lines. And if you had a cooking show, you too would wear Nigella's jewel-coloured twin sets over extra-strength control garments. Garments that kick your gut to your tits and your thighs to your ass, giving you a fake waist just like hers. You can barely breathe with them on, and your sweat stings your chafing skin, but you'd wear them were you hefting your body around a set, but you're not. You're just going to work as the ward nurse on respiratory, and you have to wear a navy blue and white uniform, and so you don't wear control garments. You let it pour where it will, and it will. It will pour. As a rule, all of my friends met me at eateries, and for a bunch of skinny girls, they would eat a surprising quantity of sausage rolls, lasagna with extra cheese and fries. They would stuff their bony faces with food dripping in fat, as if my bulky presence somehow liberated them. I would eat something small and watch them groan with pleasure and lick their knives and stuff their faces. Oh, how I love these extra large, flaky, pastry sausage rolls. I'm so addicted to them, I might be naughty and get another. I knew the next day, the next 7 days, there'd be celery and carrots in penitence. But it seemed they had to pretend they could eat whatever they wanted, or that with my fat eyes watching, they were temporarily free to eat whatever they wanted. Try it sometime as an experiment. Eat lunch with a fat friend. I bet you order dessert. As for me, I was always sitting at some eatery next to some binging skinny friend, conscious of the double chin sliding down my neck and trying to eat healthy, normal-sized food. Because contrary to popular imagination, once you are fat, you only need to eat a normal amount of food to stay that way. Fat people do not eat 500 pizzas and a trolley load of M&Ms each night. Oh, no, they don't. Once they have become fat, they eat just like you. Once grown, the fat is perfectly content to stay there in its soft rolls, untended, sworn at and despised. Fat has very few needs. But then my fat starts to melt away quite quickly, as it turns out. And I haven't seen Tina for 6 months until one Saturday we meet again in the spot that we meet, out the front of Seamstress Restaurant. I'm leaning against the door frame, hands in the front pockets of my new, skinny, tight jeans, and she comes up behind me and she's not sure it's me. I know she hopes it's not me, by the way. She says, "Hello, Mandy?" and peeks around me like I'm a thin corner. And there might be a murderer on the other side of the corner. Because guess what? I lost 32 kilos, enough fat to fill a wheelbarrow, my doctor told me, and then laughed. And guess what? My ass is not big. In fact, my ass is now definitely, unmistakably smaller than her ass. And she's not smiling when she makes it round the corner, that is me. And there is that fear look in her eyes as if my ass is a murderer. And I wonder, why would my ass make my friend Tina afraid?
That's short story writer Karen Hitchcock. Gretel Colleen came on the program a few months ago to talk about an ex of hers. Gretel had written a fictionalised account of her relationship with a man that she called Jimmy. And it was all about why Jimmy was such an impossible boyfriend and why he remains an infuriating friend for her, but a very close one nonetheless. And I asked Gretel if Jimmy minded her going on here in front of a microphone and talking about him like this.
I actually rang him last night and I said, "Do you mind? You know, I'll be talking to Richard tomorrow. I just want to know, like, the parameters. Like, do you mind if, for example, I mention that time you rang me and you were in that woman's car and she was giving you Botox in your forehead while you had a ferret in a cage on your lap?" And "No, darling, no, darling, go for it." And I just, we met at a charity fundraiser and he was drinking in those days and I was dancing with Bob Hawke. It was a country and western thing for some reason.
So there you are dancing with Bob Hawke and Jimmy.
Fell on the floor, though, tripped. So that was unfortunate. And I remember Jimmy came up.
He fell on the floor.
Look, I think it was my fault, to be honest.
Sorry, who fell on the floor?
Me.
You did?
Yeah. I wasn't drunk. And then Jimmy came up to me. He was particularly impressed because there was some – he's a real star make loverer, if you know the phrase I'm referring to. He loves famous people.
Right.
So when he and I used to go out 17 years ago, he spent a great deal of time looking over my shoulder looking for someone more interesting, beautiful or famous. But there was some, you know, as it turns out, fly-by-night actress who was sitting on my other side who Jimmy – was infatuated by because she was famous, and she ignored him. So I was really second, came off the rank, and I can remember him wanting to impress me and showing me his driver's license. And it had expired, of course, but you know, he didn't seem to care about that. And then I bumped into him when my children and I moved into Darlinghurst. It turned out that he frequented the same cafe, and he gave my daughter his phone number and some sweet message. I mean, in those days,
What did he tell your daughter? When he gave...
Oh, she was three.
And she was three.
Do you remember my daughter in those days? Mm. She used to wear high heels and dress as a Spanish bride.
Mm.
Now she dresses like someone off the Jerry Springer show, but that's another story.
Hello, Epi. Hello. So what did he say as he passed his phone number to your three-year-old daughter?
You know, give this to your mum.
Give this to mummy.
And I don't think I replied... No, I don't think I rang, and he just simply persisted, and that was it.
So look, I'm hearing all this stuff right now.
Mm.
You better tell me why you said yes to his approach to you, Gretel.
I think, in a way, he looks like a father figure. He's very tall and very strong. But this is because he goes to the gym and only works out his upper muscles. So his arms are huge. He looks fantastic, but, you know, his legs.
Are you one of those women who are attracted to father figure type?
Yes, but as it turns out, and this is the dangerous part of it, he, as it turns out, was attracted to me because I was a mother type figure. So it was destined.
So you're playing mummies and daddies.
It's only in retrospect.
Now we're going through his shortcomings here. What would he say are your shortcomings, Gretel Colleen?
He thinks, what are they? He thinks...
I'm trying
to put my head into it. He thinks I'm too polite. He thinks I care too much about what other people think. He thinks I boss him around. He thinks I'm attracted to idiots, which is ironic, really.
Could you live with him?
Oh, God, no. He goes to bed dressed like a pixie, like a very tall pixie. And... he's on the toilet all the time and talks all the time and he's messy and he can't sleep and he has to eat the same meals at the same time every day.
I'm definitely bringing him on for equal time because when I asked you if he would have criticisms of you and your only comeback to that was, well, if anything, I'm too perfect. So, Gretel Colleen.
I'm too forgiving. That's my problem.
I'm just too nice and too perfect. After a while, it became apparent to many people who this Jimmy was. Jimmy's a well-known, brilliant, and slightly untidy criminal barrister. The very man that ABC TV series Rake is based upon. Indeed, he contributed many of the stories to Rake. And as a lawyer, Jimmy often has colourful clients, according to Gretel. Was his life ever in danger from disgruntled clients?
One time he rang me, because he often rings me, he rings a lot. Or he'll just send me a text, which he did last week, that said, help. So I, of course, rang. He said, what are you ringing for, darling? I said, well, you sent me the text saying help. Oh, yes, I've moved on from that. Oh, my Lord. So there was one thing when some disgruntled clients wanted to kill him. And they arranged a meeting.
Oh, I'm laughing at this.
They arranged a meeting time, which Jimmy agreed to. But the problem with Jimmy that the criminals didn't realise is he's very unreliable. So, and they should have known better because they arranged to kill him and Jimmy was, of course, late and so they'd gone.
Okay. Is he an unlucky guy or a lucky guy?
He is very loved and that is a very lucky thing in life. One could say... he's unlucky in the sense that I remember that cafe where the three of us used to go, and I do remember his car was parked in the street there. And on one day, two separate cars drove into it.
Well, different, separate incidents on the same
separate
day.
Separate incidents.
Right.
But he's also foolish. He got another car, but he had to sell that car because he had so many parking fines. that he had to get the funds to pay the parking fines by selling the car. So he just doesn't get life. And then one time, he looks bedraggled too. One time I remember he'd locked himself out of his apartment and he was sitting on the step waiting for the locksmith to come, and he just had his stuff on the ground in front of him and someone walked past and threw him some coins.
That's lucky.
That's lucky, but he is lucky because he has a bedraggled group of us who have stood by him through thick and thin, and I don't know why. And it did occur to me that maybe in another life I murdered him.
Well, the Jimmy that's being spoken of is, in fact, a man called Charlie Waterstreet. Charlie is a contributor to the Sun Herald newspaper in Sydney and, indeed, a well-known criminal barrister. And I thought it only fair, after all that, to bring Charlie on and let him answer these charges by his ex-girlfriend, Gretel Colleen. Were you listening when Gretel was on the program?
I didn't, but I got a podcast. You're very popular with us pod people. And I was shocked and horrified and immediately rang my defamation lawyers, who pointed out to me that because it was true, that I couldn't sue. But it was insulting and it was hurtful, but it was true. And that's the only thing that could be said for it.
This is how she sketched your personality, Charlie. He's a character. He's one of my best friends. Brilliant. Older than I am. Very bright, but incredibly dumb at the same time. Alcoholic, bankrupt, bon vivant, very funny, but can't function at some level. Do you want to dispute any of that, Charlie?
4 out of 6. I'd say 4 out of 6 right, and the other two are completely wrong.
Look, she also said, she related an incident, I don't know if you remember this or not, she said, witnessed you injecting Botox into yourself in the back of a car while holding a ferret in a cage. Does that ring true at all?
Your point being? Of course I've done that, but who hasn't?
Who hasn't? This day and age.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
Today, the final conversations for this year. Funny Stories 2010. And for some reason, this year, all the stories are from women. That's how it goes. Coming up, Susan Mousehart, who cruelly deprived her teenage children from any access to TVs, computers, and iPhones. They went digital detox, and she lived to tell the tale. Also, there'll be Mary Wilson from The Supremes and soul music legend Darlene Love from 60s girl group The Blossoms, who not only gave Elvis the knockback, but Tom Jones too, because at the crucial moment, Tom opened his mouth and he said something. That's coming up. Comedian Corinne Grant might be a familiar face to you from programs like The Glass House and Rove Live. Corinne came on to talk about her habit of hoarding stuff, way past the point that it could do her any good. She kicked the hoarding habit and she wrote a book about it. But Corinne made the mistake of talking to someone from Channel 7's morally imperfect current affairs program Today Tonight, which blew her hoarding problem a little out of proportion. Can we just deal with the TV beauty secret shame sort of thing from Today
Tonight?
Oh, my
goodness, yes. Well, it's very interesting because I think there's different levels of hoarding. And in my book, I sort of have a sliding scale from 1 to 10. And Today Tonight did imply that I was a level 10 hoarder, the person who, you know, has a proper psychological illness with the yard full of stuff and the house full of stuff. You know, like that show in America called Hoarders, like the people who can't move because the stuff does topple on top of them. I thought I was doing an interview about my book. I turn on the television that night, I see an ad, TV star, secret shame. And I went, I don't think this is going to work out the way I thought it was going to work out.
Well, Today Tonight's a show, we know from Media Watch, it's ethically imperfect. Nonetheless, are you proud to have a secret shame now? Are you proud?
Yes. I mean, it's wonderful. It is. It's one of those things. I think you've always wanted to get a letter from a prisoner and have a secret shame. So now I tick in both boxes. It's great.
Love child? We got a love child?
I need a secret love child, yeah. Don't I? Yeah. That's what I need. And yeah. My real secret shame is that I stand in the bushes and I watch Kerry O'Brien shower, but no one's picked that one up yet. I jokingly say that hoarders are like drug addicts. If you watch the Today Tonight special, they cut out the joking bit and it's just got me going, I'm like a drug addict. Which is hilarious. But I meant that in the way that a hoarder
yes,
will hide.
Please explain
it.
Yeah. And link to me now with nuance and context what you really
what
meant
I really
when
meant.
You said to Today Tonight you were like a drug addict.
In hindsight, I can see how using those words in an interview with Today Tonight probably was going to come back and bite me on the bum, and it may have been my own fault. I didn't think about the editing process. I only do live interviews now, nothing pre-recorded.
Yes.
So when I say that hoarders are like drug addicts, it's that you can hide it. You can appear like you're a normal person. So I moved in with Thomas and my stuff went into a storage cage, so he never knew how much stuff I had. And like a drug addict, you don't know you're dating a hoarder until you move in together and all of a sudden the stuff comes with you and it's too late then, especially if you get married. You got the ring on your finger.
So you put it into storage. Of course, later on when you get rid of your stuff, you could have said today, I was like a serial killer remains. Corinne Grant, serial killer. Secret shame.
Oh, I should have said that,
shouldn't
I?
You should have said that. That would have been great. There was a photo amongst your stuff of you with some dead sticks in your hand.
Some dead sticks.
Why is there a photo of you holding dead sticks?
The dead sticks was when Thomas helped me move out of the hellhole and he came around to help me move house, and because I'd left the moving until the night before and hadn't packed a thing, and he turned up and he was helping me pack. And that was the first time Thomas had seen how much stuff I actually had, because it had all been in storage. And now it was there and he was looking around. And for me, I think too, that was a moment when I realised that maybe I did have too much stuff, is when this man standing there going, my God. Have you been broken into, and did they bring stuff with them? What is all of this stuff?
Reverse burglary.
Yes. And I was being ridiculous about it. And I decided that, you know, obviously I probably did have a few more things, and well, probably more things than what a man has, because men never keep anything. And I would have to explain these things and justify their belongings. And when you're a kid in the country, the theory is that if you call an animal a name, you can't really kill it anymore. If your chook is just a chook, it's easy to have for Christmas dinner. If you call the chook Betty, then you're murdering Betty. So with all of these objects, I decided to Betty them up. So all of these things, there's some stuff's going in a bin, but very little of it. We get to this point and I turn around and he's lost his mind by this stage. And Thomas was a very calm person. I turn around and he's holding this bunch of sticks and he goes, Corinne, what in Christ's name am I holding? And I said, well, that's the first bunch of flowers the first ever boyfriend I ever had gave me. And he said, they're dead sticks. They're sticks. And I said, I think you'll find they're a dried arrangement. Which they very clearly weren't. They were dead sticks with a little bit of red ribbon around them. I had a massive fight about it. He said, I can't put these in a box. These have to be thrown out. And I was sobbing and I was so embarrassed by the fact that I was crying in front of him. And he's just refused to put them in a box. In the end, we compromised and he let me take a photo of them before he threw them out. But this photograph is just his arm. Like, he refused to actually be in the photo with the sticks. He already felt that he was enabling me enough.
That's Corinne Grant, who no longer hangs onto her stuff quite so tightly as she used to. Think now how fiercely you would react if someone came to take all the screens in your house away. The TV, the computer, iPad, laptop, smartphone. And with that thought, if you suddenly feel all defensive, then that could be a sign you might be mildly addicted to this stuff. Susan Mousehart is an American-Australian writer who was living in WA when she decided to put herself and her three teenage children on a six-month total digital detox. And when Susan came on, she began by explaining the difference between a digital immigrant, like herself, and digital natives, like her kids.
A digital native is somebody who is basically under the age of about 25, who's grown up using computers with the dummy in one hand and the computer mouse in the other, whose, you know, first words included, you know, mama, papa, more, and pooter. Kids who just don't understand because they've never experienced a life pre-digital technology. And these are the kinds of people who, when a new gadget comes into the house, just sneer at anybody who looks at an instruction manual. They just kind of know. It's just kind of, it seems like it's encoded in their DNA. They take the iPod, they plug it in, and they're off. They've changed the display picture. They've customized the ringtone. They've figured out how to get, you know, full color animated emoticons on, and you're still on page one of the tutorial for idiots, a.k.a. the digital immigrant, because a digital immigrant is usually the parent or perhaps the grandparent of one of these natives who speaks download with a very thick accent.
Okay, so you're in the new country as a digital immigrant yourself.
Right.
You need the phrase book, which is the instruction manual.
And I always get it wrong. Digital immigrants always get it wrong. They always say things like, I'll write to you on Facebook, and your digital native will just slap her forehead and say, it's post, or whatever they say, you know, right. So you can always tell because they never quite use the right terminology.
So you envisaged this experiment would be like an extended trip back to the old country, in other words.
Right, right.
The old country of non-digital technology.
Yes, I saw it as kind of time travel. And I, when friends of mine said, why, you know, are you doing this to your kids? I said, well, I'm doing it for the same reason that I would take them, if I could afford it, on a long, you know, European holiday. I want them to experience another land, another set of assumptions, another way of spending time, and another sort of set of values. Let me just preface these remarks by saying that I am not a golden ager. Okay, I'm not one of these people who believes that
everything was great and more simple.
Yes, and it was more, you know, kind of more authentic, and eggs tasted better, and the ocean was prettier, and all of that stuff. I actually hate that. You know those emails that go around saying, remember the 60s, you know, when we drank from the hose and we rode our bikes all day?
Yeah,
and
you look at stuff from pop culture of the 60s and they go, remember the 40s when we used to...
Right. I mean, in my childhood, we were so authentic, we ate aerosol cheese on, you know, crackers. So please.
So there you are. You've got three kids in Fremantle in WA, and you make this decision to go digital detox on your kids. How did you get them to go along with this?
Okay, well, the first time I announced that I was doing it, or I said, you know, what would our lives be like if we didn't have all this junk? You know, I just think we should just pull the plug on everything and just do away with all the screens. I was met with total silence, which stunned me. And then I realized nobody could hear me because they all had their earbuds in. But then when I lowered the boom for real, which I did on Christmas Day, Christmas morning, God, what a Grinch. And in fact, it worked pretty well. Initially, I think they were so shocked. They were so blindsided by the idea. And I am given to manias. You know, I'm the kind of person I'm always coming up with, you know, I have a fabulous idea. Let's from now on, all we'll eat is Greek yogurt. OK, that's because you don't need anything else, you know, an apple maybe. And so people just kind of get used to rolling their eyes.
It'll last a week, maybe. Tops.
Right.
That's what they figured.
Exactly. I found out that later when the kids, you know, participated in some publicity for the book and they were asked, you know, by Today, Tonight or whoever, what, you know, what was your first reaction? And they all said, we didn't really believe it. And I guess that's why they fell over initially so quickly. But also, I told them that, well, I was thinking of writing a book, you know, if the experiment went, you know, well, and sort of keeping notes and, you know, there was a possibility. And then it was like, a book? You mean like for money? You're going to make money out of our pain? What do we get out of this? But I had anticipated that. And funnily enough, it worked so well because I said, well, okay, I hear what you're saying. I could cut you in on this deal if there is one, if I do get the book published. But I'm never going to get the book published unless you are 100% faithful to this contract. And they kind of looked at each other and said, yep, okay, we'll do it then.
Bribery.
Absolutely.
Bribery worked in this case.
Incentivization is how I prefer to think of it.
One of the things I loved about it, one of their first responses, and I know this is common for teenagers at the moment, they looked at you right in the eye and they went, what does this mean for our homework? Wow. What a big fat lot of is that?
I mean,
that's the thing. I need this digital technology so I can do my homework. My homework is so important to me. Homework.
And not only the kids who tried to snow me with this, but other parents totally snowed by the homework thing. How could you do this to your children? What about their schoolwork? I was like, oh, come on. Do you honestly believe that they're doing homework for like 6 hours every night with like 10 open windows on Firefox and like suction to Facebook and with a Skype image of their friend in the corner of the thing? That is not homework.
That's not homework. You hear stories about parents walking into their teenagers' bedrooms who are doing homework. And then the teenager quickly goes, you know, like that.
Of course.
And then five screens blink out immediately.
Absolutely.
Right.
Or we have all mastered the art of the kind of backward hug where you loom up over your child and sort of pretend to give them a hug from behind so you can see what the hell they're doing on that screen in front of them.
I want to read one of your diary entries here, which is hilarious. This is the date of the 9th of January, which I'm assuming is, what, a week into it? The experiment?
5 days, yeah.
5 days. Mm. This is your diary entry. Tension. Fought with A, which I'm assuming is your daughter.
Right.
Fought with A about dishes, credit card charge for overdue books, and general princessy attitude. Returned home from clubs last night at 2 a.m. You're right, this is your daughter. Mm. Silently handed her and friend a lantern and stalked back to bed. Sorry about my freaky house, Laura, she called out, is blaming the experiment for everything undone, disorganised and dysfunctional in her life right now. Literally ask myself on a daily, if not hourly basis, where I have gone wrong. Powerlessness, don't get me started. Yeah, great yes. one, Mum.
Yes, yeah. yes, it's true. It's true. The number of times I heard, this whole thing was your idea. So give me $25 to go to the movies. This whole thing was your idea. So the least you could do is take us out to dinner. This whole thing was your idea.
Well, Susan's family eventually accepted the digital detox. Her son took up a musical instrument. Her daughter caught up on sleep that she'd been missing for years. The family spent more time eating together and talking. And when the 6 months was up, they returned to their digital toys, but with fond memories of that screen-free magical place they'd all been to for a while on holidays, a place where they'd been happy.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can subscribe totally free to the Conversations podcast. Details on the website. abc.net.au/conversations.
Today on the final Conversations for 2010, it's funny stories, and I'm going to finish up with two women. Both of them are from legendary girl groups of the 60s. The first, Mary Wilson, came from the Detroit Housing Projects, and she was a co-founder of the Supremes, the only group that ever rivaled the Beatles for chart dominance at that time. It was inevitable, I suppose, that the Supremes would meet the Fab Four one day. But how would these Motown girls get on with four lads from Liverpool?
We were very square, the Supremes. We went to see the Beatles. Well, we were working in New York, and they were doing the Shea Stadium or something like that. So our publicity people said, let's get these two major groups together, right? And so they planned the whole thing, and they said, well, Beatles can't get out of their hotel, but we'll take you over. So we go over in this huge limousine, pull up in front of the hotel where they were staying, and all these screaming girls came going, ah! And as soon as they opened the door and saw it was like girls, they like ran the other way because they were looking for the Beatles. Anyway, so we're escorted up to the Beatles, you know, suite, and it was dark and smoky in there. And we had on our little gloves, you know, our little hats, and we were all cute. We were like Jackie Onassis cute, you know, because we were really sharp little girls.
Bouffant hairdos.
Oh, bouffant. Oh, yeah, we were beehives. We were like really cool. We were like ever so chic. And so when we went in there, all kind of, they were all rock and rollers, and it was like dark, and people were like in the corner and this and that. And we were like, wow, where? We thought it was going to be, you know, this huge cocktail kind of party with the glamour and then this, and it wasn't all that. So after a while, we asked our PR people, we said, can we get out of here? George Harrison and I became friends after that, and he said, and we were talking about the meeting. He says, yeah, and we kept saying, when are these square girls going to leave? Because they're killing our style, you know what I mean? So just, I said all that to say, we were very different from most of the other people out there singing.
Over the years, I read somewhere, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that you've been romantically linked over the years with... I'm going to give you three names. Tom Jones, Steve McQueen, and Flip Wilson. I cannot think of three more different men in the whole universe than Tom Jones, Steve McQueen, and Flip Wilson.
It's like a car. They all have four wheels, right? Okay, now, but let's get back to this. Girls, ladies, pay attention to what I'm about to say. Because I think it's unfair that guys can have as many girlfriends as they want, and then I have three.
What I'm astonished by is that
I want it from a man's perspective.
Of course it's all
I
right.
want to know what you... What do you want me to say, Richard?
I just think that such three different guys. The star of Bullet, the guy who sang Delilah, and comedian Flip Wilson.
That is very true. It doesn't matter to me. You know, it's about the chemistry with the man, to me. So I don't... care what they look like, or well, I do really, but
they got,
you know.
Four wheels. They got four wheels.
Yeah, that's a good one. Huh?
Mary Wilson from the Supremes. It's Funny Stories 2010, and the final one is from Darlene Love. Darlene Love started out as a gospel singer before she was discovered by Phil Spector, who used her beautiful big voice again and again. It was Darlene Love who sang that song, He's a Rebel, under the name of The Crystals, but it was actually her group, The Blossoms, that did it. She sang next to Aretha Franklin and Tom Jones and Sam Cooke. Darlene Love sang backup for Elvis when he put on the black leather suit for his electrifying 68 comeback special. And Darlene said that in between takes, Elvis would wander over to sing gospel music with her group. Later, Darlene Love appeared with Elvis in the movie Change of Habit when Elvis thought he might step up the friendship a bit.
It was a lunch break. Elvis decided he was going to stay in his cabin, and the Blossoms were getting ready to leave. I think we had like 2 hours between scenes. And I went back to the dressing room to get something, and the girls went on wherever they were going. And I was walking by his trailer, and he looked out and saw me. He said, "Darlene, come here." And I went, "Oh, okay. Hi." I had no idea really what he wanted.
Hi, anything. Elvis.
Yes. You know, and any time I was alone with him, I got nervous anyway because it was Elvis Presley. And he called me, and I went, "Have a seat. How you doing? How's everything going? You know how?" And then it got around to, "You know, you just don't want to know really what I'm thinking about right now." And I said, "No, I have no idea." He said, "Well, you know, for what I'm thinking about right now, my grandparents would be turning over in their grave." And I went, "What, Elvis?" He said, "I never even thought about having a black woman or even thought about even what it would be like or anything." And I went, "Well, I guess you'll never know, huh?"
I'm so scandalized. You gave the knockback to Elvis.
Well, I had to come back with something, you know, especially because how he was talking about it, you know. And I was just, "Well, baby, you ain't going to find out with me, so let's just stay friends and let's finish this movie and you go your way and I'll go mine."
But, you know, Darlene, it was Elvis.
I know. I was scared. I don't even say what I was.
You know, he's a very handsome man.
I was so scared.
You're a very attractive woman. You're young. You're just in the trailer. I mean,
I was scared, let me tell you. Can you imagine? I'm in a room with Elvis and he's hitting on me. I didn't know anything else to say, but I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I know. And nobody believes this story because it was just me and him.
Darlene Love, the woman who should be famous for nothing else except for giving the knockback to Elvis. And I'm not talking about 77 Elvis. I'm talking about 68 comeback special Elvis,
right.
Black leather Elvis. You also went on tour with the other great big beast of music, Tom Jones.
Oh, yeah, that was nice too.
Yeah. Now, he was always trying to get he would always have a party in afterwards. He was always trying to get the Blossoms to come, but the Blossoms wouldn't go.
We had always heard that that Tom Jones' parties were wild with women and doing all kind of crazy things, and we didn't want to be a part of that, honey. If I go to jail, I'm going to jail because something I did, not because of something somebody else got caught doing. So, Elvis... Tom Jones and his two bodyguards came down to our rooms, knocked on the door. "Oh, come on now, girls. You guys can come to our parties." We said, "We ain't going because we didn't heard about all the stuff y'all do." "Oh, it's not like that. Come on down to our parties." So we did. We started going to his parties. Everything was nice. Then we said, "Well, we leave. We're going to bed here." But, "Okay, bring out the girls. The Blossoms are leaving." But we, you know, and Tom had his own airplane at the time. They leased a plane from an airline. And I would sit, wherever I sat, Tom would sit in front of me.
Why?
And I don't know. I'd put my foot, you know, like between the window and his seat, and he would play with my feet. And I'd say, "Man, if you don't leave my feet alone." You know, that's how this all started, this little tut-tut we thought we were going to have together. But Tom used to tell me about all these women. All these women. "Oh, you know, Darlene, we became one of these." He could just tell me about anybody. We told me about a few women that I didn't like what he was saying about them. But I'm like, "Yeah, he's telling me stuff." So
you just figured he was bad for you?
Yes. But one night, we had all been drinking and partying, having a good time. And Tom said, "Darlene, come on down to my room. I want you to hear something." I went, "Okay." So I went down to his room. And his bodyguard always stayed right next door. And the door was already always open. I guess they wanted to know or protect him or whatever. And I decided to go to his room. And we got to holding hands and kissing. And, you know, we got in the bed, no clothes on. And we just started talking. He started telling me about the affairs with the ladies. Then he told me about this one black lady that he had this affair with. And we knew he had an affair with her because when we was working in Las Vegas, we used to see her with him all the time. And when he called her name out when we were in the bed, I had this affair with so-and-so, but, you know, she wasn't really a good a show for the black women. I went, "Excuse me?" I said, "Well, that's it, buddy. I'm going back to my room because you ain't going to hang my name with the rest of them."
I got up and put my clothes on and went back to my room. You ain't linking my name. It might not be what you think it's supposed to be. And you be telling folks, I had an affair with Darling Love, and she really wasn't a good representative of the black woman.
Cop that, Tom.
Hysterical, because like he said, you're the first woman that ever been in my bed, and I didn't get a turn with you.
There you go. That's Darling Love. Remember, the full conversations with all these amazing women are available on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. And you can get them all through iTunes too. Thanks for being with me today and this year. I'm Richard Feidler, ABC Local Radio.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.